Good morning.
Good morning.
How's everyone doing? Can you hear me okay?
Point the mic at you.
Okay.
It's direction.
Okay. But then I can't see my paper. I'll put my paper over here. It's always something. Speaking of which, something feels different today. I can't quite put my finger on it. Yeah, you're right. You can see. I can see everyone really well. And I hope you can see me well, too, because that's kind of the point of bringing in this high seat that I'm sitting on today. It's so I'll be visible to everyone in our kind of crowded and awkward space. And it's not meant to elevate the teacher in any other way, you know. It's just me. It's Ted, you know. Just a guy. I'm just a guy who has made a commitment and undertaken some study, and I'm sharing some of what I've learned with you. And you are welcome to take it or leave it according to whether it fits with your experience or not, whether it's helpful to you and whether it makes sense. So there's no pretense that the teacher is all-knowing, and this particular teacher is not. But he is very visible. And thanks to one of our Sangha members, Dale, for making this platform. Is Dale here? There he is, way back in the corner. Thank you, Dale. You do nice work. All right. Thank you. So today, as soon as I have a sip of water, I'm going to talk about the Kula Dukkha Kanda Sutta. I love to say that. I love these. Pali and Sanskrit are both beautiful languages, and this is Pali. And in Pali, they like to put several words together to make one word, kind of like in German. So, Kula Dukkha Kanda Sutta. It's the 14th sutra from this book, the Middle-Length Discourses of the Buddha, which is a very thick book with a lot of wonderful stuff in it. And the meaning of this word, kula. Kula is a name for the little lock of hair that a monk will have remaining on his or her head after shaving. When we do our ordinations here, we call that the shura, and the teacher shaves that off during the ordination ceremony. And I think it's at that precise moment when the person becomes a monk. So that's what a kula is, and I think here it just is standing in for something small, a little thing. And then dukkha, most of you know what dukkha is. Dukkha is usually translated as suffering. And then kanda, that's the same as skanda, which is referred to in the Heart Sutra. There are the five skandas. And skanda literally means heap or aggregate. So kula dukkha kanda, we have small suffering heap. And then sutra, which is like a sermon. So it's translated as the shorter discourse on the mass of suffering. So that's what this is. And right before it is the Maha Dukkha Kanda Sutta. Maha is great, so that is the greater discourse on the mass of suffering. And this one begins, "Thus have I heard." And they all begin that way, every one of them. And this is Ananda speaking. Ananda, the Buddha's faithful attendant, who is said to have been able to recite every word the Buddha ever said. So he's reciting what the Buddha said, probably after the Buddha's death. He's telling a group of people what the Buddha said. So on one occasion, the Blessed One was living in the Shakyan country at Kapilavatthu in Nigrodha's park. So the Shakyan country, that's where the Buddha came from, where he was born, hence Shakyamuni Buddha. So he traveled a lot teaching, but he happens to be back in his hometown right now teaching at a place called Kapilavatthu in Nigrodha's park. So Nigrodha, I think, was probably a wealthy person who had a park, which was probably a forest or a pasture or something, and he allowed the Buddha and his followers to stay there. And it begins, "Then Mahanama, the Shakyan, went to the Blessed One." So Mahanama is one of the Buddha's followers. He's also a Shakyan. And after paying homage to him, probably did some bows, he sat down at one side and said, "Venerable Sir, I have long understood the Dharma taught by the Blessed One thus. Greed is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Hate is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Delusion is an imperfection that defiles the mind. Yet while I understand the Dhamma taught by the Blessed One thus, at times states of greed, hate, and delusion invade my mind and remain. I have wondered, Venerable Sir, what state is still unabandoned by me internally, owing to which at times these states of greed, hate, and delusion invade my mind and remain." So when I read this, this really intrigued me. And it's the reason I wanted to read further, and it's the reason that I wanted to do a talk on this. And it intrigued me because this sounds so much like Dokusan to me. And Dokusan, as many of you know, because many of you have done this often many times, Dokusan is a personal interview or a meeting with a Zen teacher. If you're new, you might sign up for a practice meeting, which is kind of informal, and you discuss your practice and the teacher is supportive. Dokusan is a little more formal, where the teacher and student sit pretty close together, and it varies what happens. People often, they come to Dokusan, they say, "Well, what do I do? I don't know." There's several things you can do. If you have questions for the teacher, you can ask questions. You can tell the teacher a little bit about yourself, so you get to know each other better, which is always nice. You can talk a little bit about maybe your spiritual history and how you came to be here, what your practice is like. I'm always interested in hearing that. And then sometimes that'll lead into a discussion of, well, where might my practice go now, or something like that. And the whole idea behind Dokusan is simply for the teacher to be very supportive of your practice and to help you in any way he or she can. So I encourage you to do it. It's an important part of the process here. So Mahanama comes in and basically he says to the Buddha, "You know, my practice is not going so well. I'm having some problems here." Mahanama is an experienced practitioner. He's a lay person. He was a cousin of the Buddha, and he's the brother of Anuruddha and Ananda, Ananda whom I mentioned a little while ago. And Mahanama had chosen not to ordain. He had chosen to stay behind and be a householder. He said Anuruddha didn't know anything about running a household, and somebody had to do it. So he stayed behind. And he's been at it for a while. We have a footnote here that says, according to a commentary, Mahanama had long ago attained the fruit of the once returner, which is a stage in Theravadan Buddhism. They tend to talk about stages, which we don't talk about very much in Zen. The once returner, which only weakens greed, hate, and delusion, but does not eradicate them. So he had attained this state, and maybe he had this sort of initial insight, and maybe some ecstasy, and maybe his self dropped away for a couple of days, and he felt really wonderful. And then maybe after being ego-free for a while, his ego kind of came back in, and he was free from greed, anger, and self-delusion for a little while, and then those things came back in, and he's really disappointed, and he's troubled, and he goes to the Buddha and talks about that. So let's look again at what Mahanama said. He said that he's long understood the Dhamma, that, you know, greed defiles the mind, hate defiles the mind, delusion is an imperfection. I get this stuff. I understand this stuff. And yet it persists. That stuff keeps coming back in. And obviously, there is some state that I have not abandoned. How do I do that? What do I do about this? And this sounds really familiar to me, and I'm not the Buddha by any stretch of the imagination, despite my high seat here. But I do have this teacher-student interview, and this seems pretty familiar to me because A number of experienced practitioners have talked to me about this same kind of problem. I've been doing this a long time, and I thought things were going pretty well, and it's sort of not working anymore, or some variation on that. And I don't want to reduce meditation experience to something pat or predictable, because it is certainly not the same way for everyone, and it changes all the time for a lot of people. But sometimes there are these patterns that emerge that you can talk about. It may be initially very hard when you first start doing this practice, and you sit for a half hour, and you really try to discipline your mind for an entire half hour while it's just racing all over the place. That can be very, very difficult. But if you stick with it, you might find that things just happen kind of gradually, or they're almost imperceptible. But sometimes things happen kind of quickly, and you start feeling really good. And you get this glow about you a little ways into the practice. And I've seen that happen a number of times, and it's really beautiful. And you're like, wow, I'm going to do this forever. And then, after a while, maybe you're not so ecstatic, and you start noticing those that you have not given up all of those afflictive emotions, and it seems to become hard again. And this happens in various forms. One thing is that it's the disappointment that arises. You think you're there, like, oh, I've got this. And then you kind of realize, well, I don't have this. I got an initial glimpse, but I still need to do the work. And sometimes you get that initial glimpse, you feel really good, you stop doing the work. Like, I've got it now. I don't have to sit anymore. And then everything falls apart. And this is where Mahanama is, I think. And a footnote says, he had the mistaken notion that greed, hate, and delusion are eradicated by the path of the once returner. But that is not true. Another thing that may happen to an experienced practitioner is you may think, well, I'm just not making any progress. You know, I was going like this. If I graph my practice, great things were happening and it kept going up like this. And I just kind of plateaued. I'm just kind of staying in the same place now. And I'm not seeing that increase anymore. And I find this disappointing. Or maybe in your practice, after a while, new difficulties arise that weren't there before. And this seems like really unfair. And Tim talked last Sunday, I'm sure many of you were here, about how about 2 to 3 years into his practice, he was really having trouble and he could not sit still. And he started developing tremors in his hands. I think it was his hands. And he had a really hard time. But he persisted. He kept doing the practice, which I am eternally grateful for, because I don't think I'd be sitting here if he had not persisted. In fact, I'm sure of it. And when this happens, when these kinds of difficulties happen, sometimes people will leave. They've been faithfully doing the practice for a year or 2 years or 3 years, but they hit this stage and they leave and they say, I don't think I can do this anymore. And that usually makes me pretty sad. Sometimes it's appropriate. Meditation is not for everyone. Sometimes people will really give it their best effort and say, you know, I don't think this is quite right. I think I'm going to follow some other spiritual path, or I'm going to take up fishing or something. I say that seriously because I'm going to commune with nature or something. And then for some people, if you've experienced trauma or maybe depression or something like that, maybe more sitting is not the answer. Maybe a break is the right thing for you, because occasionally meditation can sort of make some of these mental states, these activities that go on and on and on, and you're running like a little hamster on the wheel. The idea is to calm that down, but for some folks, meditation can actually exacerbate that. And if that's the case, maybe you need to do something else. But for most people, if they sort of leave the practice at this point when it's hard, it does make me sad, because I think, oh, if you'll just stick with it and shake things up a little bit and talk to your teacher, I think you're going to get through this. And another thing that happens, and this tends to happen way down the road, and Tim talked about this last week too, is that even when you're very advanced, even if you've had a very deep experience and you're really super ego-free for quite some time, the ego always comes back. And when it does, you can kind of see that ego in stark relief. And it's like, oh, there's that again. You know, there's that desire coming up. There's hatred, anger, self-delusion. And having been away from that for a while, when you see it, it's kind of painful. And Tim talked about that last week. He said, after a big enlightenment experience, I noticed how much I was screwing up. And he went to Suzuki Roshi. And Suzuki Roshi said it was like that for me as well. And I've experienced that, and I've talked to a number of other people who have experienced that. So all of these things that can happen to make it difficult for the experienced practitioner, I've given this a grand name, which is the malaise of the experienced practitioner. And I like malaise. Malaise is a general feeling of discomfort, illness, or uneasiness whose exact cause is difficult to identify. Kind of this vague feeling of uneasiness. Come to think of it, that just sounds a lot like dukkha, doesn't it? So the long-term practitioner goes, oh, wow, there's suffering. I can't believe it. It's like, yeah. Didn't we tell you that in the beginning? You kind of forgot that, didn't you? Yeah. So maybe you've experienced that. Maybe you haven't. Maybe you're new. But I think it'll still hopefully be useful for you to hear this talk, because the Buddha gives a solution, and I think his solution is just to practice well, to have a creative practice, and that's good for everyone. But having given this a grand name, I don't want to overstate it. You know, I don't want to suggest that this is a predictable thing that happens to everyone, and that down the road terrible things will happen. For some people, this never happens in a big way. I think everyone experiences little bumps, you know. But for some people, they never have this sort of thing. I don't want to suggest that it's inevitable, but it happens for some people. So I do want to address it. So the question then is, what does the Buddha say to Mahanama about his problem? The Buddha says, Mahanama, there is still a state unabandoned by you internally, owing to which at times states of greed, hate, and delusion invade your mind and remain. So he just basically confirms that. And then he says, for were that state already abandoned by you internally, you would not be living the home life. You would not be enjoying sensual pleasures. So he's saying the problem here is enjoying sensual pleasures. That shows Mahanama. It's not so much greed, hate, and self-delusion. It's sensual pleasures. And when we hear that, I think our mind goes to things like sex, drugs, rock and roll, you know, physical comfort, everything like that, you know. And I think indulging in that kind of thing is some of what the Buddha is talking about with sensual pleasure. But I think it might be more helpful to us, and it might be more consistent with what happens in a modern Dokusan, to think of monkey mind and grasping. And because I think that's kind of the basic problem we have with our practice is our grasping mind. The kind of thing where our logical mind wants to be amused all the time and is always grabbing onto stuff. The kind of thing that makes you want to turn on your radio immediately when you get into the car. And if your radio doesn't work, you're going to sing to yourself or make up a song or engage in some kind of mental fantasy. And it's the kind of thing that makes you unable to leave your computer when you're surfing the internet because you just want more. You want more news, you know. I think we all experience that. And so Mahanama may be experiencing something like that in a kind of more low-key way, the way that may have happened 2,500 years ago. And the Buddha equates this with being a householder. He says, you know, if you weren't still stuck in this sensual pleasure realm, you would abandon householding and you would come be a monk. You would come live with me. And I find that a little troubling and a little irrelevant to our situation, because most of us, probably none of us here, are full-time monks. I'm not. We're living in this world. We're active in this world. We love being out there. And what we are looking for is a vivid practice and some peace and quiet here in this busy world. And I really, truly believe that that is achievable, and that is something that we can all do together. So saying that the householder life is equated with sensual pleasure is something I just kind of like to set aside for now. So the Buddha then goes on and he offers his solution. And here's what he says. Even though a noble disciple has seen clearly how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, much suffering, and much despair, and how great the danger is in them, as long as he still does not attain to the rapture and pleasure that are apart from sensual pleasures, apart from unwholesome states, or to something more peaceful than that, he may still be attracted to sensual pleasures. So, he has not attained the rapture and pleasure that are apart from sensual pleasures. And according to one monk who did a talk on this, a Theravadin monk, he says the Buddha is talking about enjoying a higher type of happiness rather than a lower type of happiness. So he's talking about something more peaceful than sensual pleasure. He's talking about if you can attain to that, you're just not going to want the sensual pleasures. That urge to turn on the radio is just going to diminish. You're going to get in your car and you're going to want to just drive. So it's not about eradicating grasping, but it's about seeing or being in a state of non-grasping that is pleasant. The rapture and the pleasure that are apart from sensual pleasures are the rapture and pleasure pertaining to the first and second jhanas. This is from a footnote. In Theravadin Buddhism, there are these jhanas, which are these steps of practice. And these pleasures occur in the lower jhanas, and then in the higher jhanas, there's something even more quiet than that. But we don't talk much about steps in Zen, because in Zen it's just about, no, it's just right here. If we talk about steps, that's going to be a distraction. It's here now. Forget the steps. But this thing about the raptures or the quiet or the pleasantness of practice, to me, it's kind of like you reach this tipping point, you know? You start your retreat and your grasping mind is very strong. You settle down after a while and you start kind of having the pleasure of the non-grasping mind, which is a different kind of pleasure, but it is pleasant. And that becomes strong enough that that becomes the larger thing. And you don't want to go back to the grasping mind. So that is a tipping point. And it's hard for the grasping mind to see the non-grasping mind and vice versa. And it's a little bit like going to sleep. It's late at night and your mind is very busy and you're having a lot of fun. And you just can't imagine that sleeping would be fun right now. So you don't want to go to sleep. You want to stay up. Finally, you go to sleep. You sleep all night. Your alarm goes off at 6 a.m. And you can't imagine that getting up and walking around would feel good because you're so happy being in this state of sleep. So the one thing doesn't see the other. And it's like, and I've used this example before, which I don't remember where I heard this, from some teacher, I think, that it's like explaining walking to a fish. You're explaining to the fish what it's like. You go on land, and instead of fins, you have these legs, and you put one leg ahead of you and then the other one, and this is how it works. And the fish listens very carefully to the whole thing, and the fish says, oh, yeah, swimming, I get it. You're telling me about swimming. No, it's not swimming. It is really something different. Fish can't visualize that. So you get to this tipping point where the Dharma is drawing you. You don't have to discipline yourself to do it. Rather, it's drawing you, and all you've got to do is kind of surrender to it and be there. And that, I think, is what the Buddha is talking about, the pleasure and rapture that are separate from sensual pleasures. So it's not a state of fighting your urges, but a state of resting in non-urges. So then, how does the Buddha help Mahanama with this? He says, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, I too clearly saw as it actually is with proper wisdom how sensual pleasures provide little gratification, etc. But then eventually he saw it clearly and he attained that rapture and pleasure that are apart from sensual pleasures. So he says, I was like that. You can overcome this yourself, which is familiar from Dokusan also. And now he wants to give Mahanama some incentive. So he says, and what is the gratification in the case of sensual pleasures? Mahanama, there are these five chords of sensual pleasure. And then he goes back to the stuff which was covered in the greater discourse on the mass of suffering, which is all of the horrible things that can happen as a result to attachment to forms, sounds, odors, flavors, and tangibles, which I think is touch. So he goes on about that to kind of let him know that you really don't want to be trapped by sensual pleasure. And then he launches into a story. He says, now, Mahanama, on one occasion I was living at Rajagaha on the mountain Vulture Peak. So he's telling him about when he was some distance from his home. He was at Vulture Peak, which was kind of a training and retreat center. And he says, the Buddha continues, on that occasion a number of Naganthas living on the black rock on the slopes of Isi Gili. The Naganthas are also known as Jains. This is a religious sect in India. They are still there. Don't want to reduce what is certainly a complex faith to a series of bullet points, but four things that characterize Jainism are nonviolence, really big commitment to nonviolence, many-sidedness, which sounds pretty good, non-attachment, we get that, and asceticism. Okay, that's a little different from us. Asceticism, like being really rough on your body in order to attain enlightenment. The Buddha had tried all of that, right? He had been an ascetic. He had been out there and he'd kind of starved himself and he had done all kinds of things and not slept. And he did that kind of thing for years until he was in this incredibly weakened state. And then someone gave him a little bit of milk and some things happened and he realized that the middle way was the way to go, that you do not have to be so cruel to yourself in order to get enlightenment, that that's really not going to work. You're going to be so weak, you can't really deepen your spirituality. So you stay away from that. And you also stay away from, you know, just kind of a loosey-goosey, everything is cool attitude, too. You need some discipline. You need that middle path where you have discipline, but there's also some letting go and you're taking care of yourself. So these Naganthas were practicing continuous standing, rejecting seats, and were experiencing painful, racking, piercing feelings due to exertion. So they were never sitting down. They probably even slept standing up, and their legs hurt all the time. So why is the Buddha talking to Mahanama at this point about asceticism? I think that the Buddha probably senses that Mahanama feels that a possible way to cure his malaise is to double down and meditate harder and be really sort of cruel and mean to himself. And the Buddha wants to point out to him that that is not the way to go. So he continues the Buddha says he went to the Naganthas and he says, friends, why do you practice continuous standing, etc.? And they reply, friend, the Nagantha Nataputta, that's their leader, is omniscient and all-seeing and claims to have complete knowledge and vision thus. Naganthas, you have done evil actions in the past. Exhaust them with the performance of piercing austerities. So the idea is if they practice austerities, they will wear off the accumulations of past evil karma, kind of like doing penance. And maybe this sounds a little bit familiar to you. And maybe if you've ever reached this point in your practice where things aren't going so well, you think, I'm going to double down. I am going to force myself to meditate 2 hours per day, and I'm going to do all this stuff. And you make all of these vows, and you probably are not able to keep them because this doubling down that you're doing is just not quite right, you know, because you're under this illusion that the same illusion, or maybe I should say delusion, that the Naganthas are under. So then the Buddha goes into kind of a philosophical refutation of the idea that austerity eases the effects of bad karma. And I'm not going to recount that. I had a little bit of trouble following it, and it wasn't really meaningful for me. But I want to mention it. I want you to know it's there. I don't want to just sort of pick and choose the parts of the sutra that kind of fit my thesis and ignore the rest. I want you to know about that part. Let's go on. A Nagantha says, "Friend Gotama," Gotama is another name for the Buddha, "pleasure is not to be gained through pleasure. Pleasure is to be gained through pain. For were pleasure to be gained through pleasure, then King Saniya Bimbisara of Magadha would gain pleasure, since he abides in greater pleasure than the venerable Gotama." So this is the heart of their argument. Pleasure can't come from pleasure, meaning the middle way is no good. If it could come for pleasure, then the king would be happier than the Buddha. Because we know the king has all kinds of pleasures. He has great food and good things to drink and entertainment and all of that. But we know that the Buddha is happier than the king. We know that. And so pleasure can't come from pleasure, because we know the Buddha is happier than the king. And if pleasure can't come from pleasure, it has to come through pain. And the Buddha basically says, "Why don't you ask me about that?" And they do. And he says, Friends, I shall ask you a question in return. Answer it as you like. What do you think, friends? Can King Saniya Bimbisara of Magadha abide without moving his body or uttering a word, experiencing the peak of pleasure for 7 days and nights?" And they admit, "No." And then he goes on, "Can he do that for 6 days? Can he do it for five? Can he do it for even 1 day?" And they say, no, he can't. So they admit that Gotama abides in greater pleasure than King Bimbisara. So the Buddha's making the point, I am happier. And he's saying, here's where you're wrong. When you think of pleasure, when you're talking about the king having more pleasure, that's sensual pleasure you're talking about. There's this different kind of pleasure. There's the kind of pleasure I experience when I'm sitting for 7 days. Not the grasping pleasure. It is the pleasure of the absence of grasping. It has nothing to do with desire and fulfillment of desire. It has to do with cessation of desire. And that's where you're wrong. You're thinking of pleasure in the wrong terms. You're like a fish that can't imagine land. Or you simply can't imagine the true deep pleasure of simply sitting. So you're like one who is sleeping and can't imagine that it would feel good to wake up. So the Buddha is saying, please accept that there is a pleasure of non-attachment which is different from sensual pleasure, more deep and real. And you can find this not through asceticism, but through welcoming a calm and quiet state, through calming and quieting and resting the mind. Resting the mind. The Buddha is reminding Mahanama of joy. The joy of this practice. You don't have to stand continuously. You don't have to stand on one leg. You don't have to expose yourself to agony all the time. Relax. Let it go. Let it be. Let it be what it is. And accept that joy. Please, Mahanama. And Mahanama, the thing is, you are wanting something, and it's wearing you out. You're wanting an end to your afflictive emotions. But I'm sorry, your afflictive emotions still exist, and they always will. Stop fighting. Drop your expectations. You learn to do that when your practice is new, and somehow you forgot that. You forgot that, and you're saying, why am I not getting anywhere? And the Buddha is here to remind him that there is no place to go. And then we come to the end of the sutra. That is what the Blessed One said. Mahanama the Shakyan was satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. So there's a happy ending. And maybe Mahanama went out of Dokusan feeling pretty good. Maybe, you know, feeling a little giddy, as sometimes happens. It's just this. It's just this. I'm not going to fulfill my desires. That can't work. It's just this being here. It's this one bright thing. It's just this, this quiet, peaceful pleasure. And he's able to go through his day, and he takes a walk around the lake, and it's all okay. So I have just a few more comments about this malaise. If you're a new practitioner or a long-term practitioner, and you're feeling it's not working any longer, I saw there used to be a cartoon years ago posted downstairs of this line of monks facing the wall, and the one had pulled out a cell phone, and he's saying, "This just isn't working." You may be thinking it should be working faster, or maybe it's no longer pleasurable, you're not feeling that ecstasy, or maybe you're seeing the starkness of your own ego. Remember the middle path. Don't double down. Open yourself to the joy of practice. Maybe there's some variation you can do, something different about your practice. Maybe less sitting and more kinhin. Maybe mindful work, which some people find very restorative. Maybe you shake it up a little bit. Maybe you sit in a new place or you sit at a new time. Maybe you go sit by the waterfall. Maybe you sit alone or maybe you sit with others, whatever you haven't been doing. Or maybe you just hold that question, what is the appropriate practice today? And you keep asking yourself that because the thing that worked yesterday may not be the thing that worked today. And remember that turning point, that shift where you find yourself on the land and not in the water. How can you encourage that shift is a question. Well, it just so happens that I chose the theme for this talk before I heard Tim's talk last Sunday, but he covered some of the same ground. He was talking, he shared some very personal stuff about transitioning out of anger after his brother's suicide. But I think what he said fits transitioning out of malaise as well. And I'm going to repeat his three types of shifts. Because some of you weren't there, and even if you were, it's not going to hurt you to hear them again. So the first shift is not what can I get from Zazen, but what can I learn about myself. So instead of looking for something, it's curiosity. If you're like, this isn't working anymore, you've kind of forgotten the basic tenet, which is that trying to get stuff does not make you happy. That's the essence of the Four Noble Truths. So instead of what can I learn about myself, maybe you ask, instead of asking how can I fulfill this need, you can ask, what is this need? What is this need I feel? What is the essence of this? Or go even deeper, who is it that feels this need? Who is it that keeps asking these questions? Who is it that keeps wanting this stuff? The second shift is from what can I learn about myself to what can I learn about my relationships with others. And again, that's the same curiosity, but this time it may lead you to more compassion. Of course, if you shift to I am doing this practice for others, it can help you with this malaise. And I think I never experienced too much of this malaise myself the first 10 or 15 years of my practice, because I think I was so focused on building Sangha and doing this for others that really kept me going. So you can do this. You can simply do your practice for all beings. And then the third shift is shifting to the possibility of waking up to a world without boundaries. So this is a very big shift. This is an end to all those distinctions we've been making. Asleep and awake, land and water, enlightened, not enlightened. Life makes me feel good, life makes me feel bad. It gets tiresome to keep making these judgments all of the time, doesn't it? Wouldn't it be great to abandon those distinctions and simply do life with no analysis and with no need? With no attainment, for there is nothing to attain. And this is more of a Zen take on this matter. It's less about transcending and more about giving up the need to transcend. There are no levels of accomplishment. There is simply this all the time, the whole deal, including the disappointment, including the delusion, including the ecstasy, including all of it, without clinging. The difference is you are not clinging to this. So the important thing is to not only see and understand the possibility of a world without boundaries, but also opening yourself to it, believing that this can happen to you. And it took me so long to get there myself. It took me so long to get to the point where I truly believed that this could happen to me, that I could experience that shift. And it was really fundamental. And I could have not have had a really deep letting go if that had not happened. So please, please keep a little part of your heart open to this possibility. Life can change us, and it can be really surprising. And I would like to end with a quote, which I really love. This quote, in researching it, I found out, I thought it was by Nelson Mandela, but I find out that it has been falsely attributed to him. And it was actually a quote from Marianne Williamson, but it's been persistently attributed to him falsely. And this kind of thing happens sometimes. I'm always seeing these quotes by the Dalai Lama on Facebook, and I think, that doesn't sound like something the Dalai Lama would say. There's one he said that when you cook, you should cook with wild abandon. And I thought, that doesn't sound like the Dalai Lama. And maybe he said that. If he said that, I'm going to have to rethink a lot of my fundamental beliefs, and not just about cooking either. But it is a wonderful quote, and my wife, Kathy, keeps this quote on her desk in this very central place, like right where she does all of her work, because she loves this quote. So it goes like this. Our deepest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our deepest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light, not our darkness, that most frightens us. We ask ourselves, who am I to be brilliant, gorgeous, talented, fabulous? Actually, who are you not to be? You are a child of God. Your playing small does not serve the world. There is nothing enlightened about shrinking so that other people don't feel insecure around you. We are meant to shine as children do. We were born to make manifest the glory of God that is within us. It's not just in some of us, it's in everyone. And as we let our own light shine, we unconsciously give other people permission to do the same. As we are liberated from our own fear, our presence automatically liberates others. So please believe this. Please believe this. I ask you this with my whole heart. So thank you so much for your kind attention. And we have a few minutes. Does anyone have something to say? Yes.
I once was at a commencement speech at the massage therapy school. My wife went to in Tempe, Arizona.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher, the person very much in charge that used that quote, also attributed to Nelson Mandela, I came up to her afterwards and brought this up to her, and she already knew Marianne Williamson said it. In her perception, she felt it was appropriate to chose to dismantle Nelson Mandela because of the heroic things he did. People want, and her rationalization, and I disagree with her, is that people want to believe Nelson Mandela came up with that on his own. And that tied in with a college teacher of mine that said that my parents' generation want to believe John F. Kennedy said, ask not what your country can do for you. fact that it was Roman-centered in Cicero. Mm-hmm. But he just said that some people want to romanticize certain things. That Cicero said that, but my parents' generation wanted to idealize John F. Kennedy to that degree.
Yeah, well, I disagree as well.
Well, I think Marianne Williamson is a brilliant author and needs a lot more credit than she gets.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I don't think people want or need to hear this. It's not a very good excuse for saying something that's not true.
People use that as a rationalization to pretty up where these brilliant thoughts come from.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I don't think Marianne Williamson is necessarily personally bitter about this, but she's well aware that people want to believe Nelson Mandela said that.
Yeah. Well, I did too. I wanted to believe that because there was something beautiful about that, but alas.
As they say, as Abraham Lincoln said, never believe everything you read on the internet.
Yeah. did you hear that in the Founders Hall? Okay. That's a good one. Yes.
Yeah, I just am. Something you said toward the end about instead of transcending, just being is the way I heard it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I'm just struck at how embedded we are in this notion of developmental steps, and that it's a sort of this linear journey somehow, and it's always about reaching higher. And I think what this really challenges is that whole frame is not always helpful.
Yeah. It is so deep. It is so deep that merely, discussing it intellectually, convincing yourself in your mind is not going to do it. This is deep in our bones or deep in our brain or something. It is incredibly deep, this idea that I have to do something now. I have to become something I'm not. And that's why we encourage meditation, deep meditation, long periods of meditation, because it's not something that's going to happen by thinking about it. It's a deep kind of letting go. I mean, it's a letting go of, who is it that's striving all the time? Who is that? And if you ask that question, maybe you can, maybe that entity, whatever it is, will kind of evaporate on its own. You can't kill it, you can't destroy it, but it'll go away of its own accord. Yes?
That's conditioned, though, because in the Western view of time and progress, and other cultures and less quote-unquote developed cultures don't necessarily, from what I understand, I'm no anthropologist, but I understand that that's not true at all. I mean, and one of the problems for us as Westerners in this tradition, Descartes into the core, is this obsession with literal progression, and gets to your whole concept of time as well as space. And I think that understanding that it's not inherent, I don't think it's inherent in human nature. It's inherent in how we're conditioned and brought up in this heavily westernized view of this.
Right.
So it's just harder for us.
Yeah, but that's encouraging. If it's not inherent, we can let it go. There is that possibility. Yes, thank you. Matt?
There's a book called Mastery. I can't remember the author's name, but he studied, it's not about spiritual development, it's about athletes.
Mm-hmm.
But what he discovered is that the level of mastery you could attain in a given field was directly related to how comfortable you were with the plateaus.
I like that. The level of mastery, it's commensurate with your comfort of at the plateau. It's true, because we all have those times when practice is like really going good, we feel like we're getting something back. Those are easy. It's like that year I had where that whole year was hard. Yeah. If you can stick with that, that's the real work.
Comfortable with
the
level that you've attained eventually.
Mm-hmm.
But they're like you're saying, it's not always straight uphill.
No, it's not. It's not. And there are those times where it's just, wow, this is not such a great day. I've just got to endure this day. That's just part of life. Yeah, thank you. Yes, Jim.
Throughout your talk today, the one thing that came to mind was something I've rewatched The Matrix recently, and it's don't try to bend the spoon because there is no spoon. But I don't have you seen the movie?
No. You know, I have really got to see that movie.
There's a child who is bending a spoon, just bending a spoon, mm-hmm. physically bending the spoon. And, the main character is played by Keanu Reeves is watching him, and the child says, hands him the spoon, says, don't try to bend the spoon. It's mm-hmm. not the spoon that's bending, it's your mind.
Mm-hmm.
I think I got that mostly right.
All right, thank you. Thank you. Maybe one more? Yes.
I encountered another theory of learning and development where not to plateau, but if you talk about becoming a beginner all over again. So as you grow, we all love the extra. And so it's probably really getting the sense of the very good, especially in the way. And you will get to the point where, in order to continue to grow, you have to step back to be a beginner.
Mm-hmm.
And if you accept that, you go, okay, I'm there again.
Right, step back to being a beginner. Well, that fits the Zen outlook pretty well, doesn't it? We talk about that all the time. Yeah, yeah. I think every time you sit down on the cushion, it's new. You don't really get credit for that stuff you did before. Yeah. All right, well, thanks everyone. That was a great discussion. I think we'll turn it over to our esteemed Doan for some announcements.